I want to say just a word about myself so that, because there's some things about me that may be helpful for you to know in connection with this series, and that is that I am relatively unusual in American college presidents in having served both in large public research land-grant universities. I was 20 years at the University of Missouri and 5 years at the University of Nebraska as teacher and administrator, and then coming to a church-related private liberal arts undergraduate college. And so most people tend to stay in kind of one track or the other. They stay in community colleges or research universities or liberal arts colleges. And I've been in several different arenas in higher education, and that's I think, given me some interesting perspectives. And I've found that very, very interesting to see higher education from such varied areas. Well, we're going to start at the beginning. What was the first college in America?
Harvard.
Harvard, and who knows when it was founded? Anybody know when it was founded? 16, that's right, 16-something. 16.
86.
36.
You
did the sixth grade,
too. Well, I said 86, I just closed it.
Yeah, but 3 out of 4.
That's not bad.
Harvard College was founded in 1636. So the origins of higher education in America are as we go, very ancient. I mean, we were not even a country, of course, at the time, and barely a society when higher education began. And it's very important to remember about American higher education that its roots, its origins, were in the Puritans. And that's where the first higher education in America came from, out of the Puritan roots. And in fact, you might be interested in the founding of Harvard. This was only six years, you see, after the arrival of the first colonists. And you know how difficult life was for the first colonists. And I find it kind of remarkable that after only 6 years of struggle and hardship and trying to get crops and accommodate to the Native Americans, all of a sudden they decide to found a college. And in fact, the General Court of Massachusetts voted to give £400 toward the founding of what was called a school or college. And I would like you to listen very carefully to the rationale for doing that. This was the rationale for the expenditure of public funds for the establishment of Harvard College. After God had carried us safe to New England, and we had builded our houses, provided necessaries for our livelihood, reared convenient places for God's worship, and settled the civil government, one of the next things we longed for and looked after was to advance learning and perpetuate it to posterity. Dreading to leave an illiterate ministry to the churches when our present ministers shall lie in dust. Now that's a very interesting thing. And among other things, it tells you that the notion of separation of church and state is a relatively relatively recent notion in this country, at least in its present rather rigid interpretation by a whole bunch of courts, including the Supreme Court last week, which said you couldn't even have a non-sectarian prayer that was voluntary at a public ceremony. But here was the General Court of Massachusetts, the government, appropriating money to establish Harvard College in order that when the present pastors of the church were gone, there would be other people who could preach the gospel. And if you were to walk on the campus of Harvard University today and remind them of that origin, they would be, most of them, rather astonished, and some of them fairly offended that their college had come out of such a religious intentionality. I mean, this was an intentionality, dreading to leave an illiterate ministry to the churches when our present ministers shall lie in the dust. And I find that very instructive, to think about that as being the seed from which American higher education has grown. Anybody know what the motto of Harvard College is and what its seal looks like? You know what the motto of Harvard is?
Veritas Professor abbreviated used to be Christo Ecclesia.
Right. And what is that word written on top of? In the seal. An open Bible. It's written on top of an open Bible.
Oh, nice.
And,
Veritas.
Truth. Yeah. But it was the truth of Christ, actually. I mean, was the original motto, and the Bible was central. And so again, it's
still a Bible on it now?
Well, I think probably they would say it's a book. It was a book, but it was a Bible originally, and they dropped the rest of the phrase. I think remembering where you came from is always interesting. Yeah, even if you have abandoned it, it's interesting to remember where you came from. Now, in the next 100 years, actually, in the next 100 years, there are only two more colleges established in America, William and Mary in 1696 and Yale in 1701. So by the end of the first century, when Harvard celebrated its centennial, there were only two other institutions to send people to the party. I mean, academics are big at parties when they have anniversaries and things, and I'm sure Harvard had a party, but there weren't very many people to come, only Yale and William and Mary. All of these colleges were founded really on the English model. The Puritans were heavily mixed in with the Puritans were a lot of people coming out of Oxford and Cambridge. And the English model, of course, is a residential college in which there is individual tutoring and mentoring, and in which the teachers live there, and there it's a kind of a community, like in somewhat the same way as Holden is, that one learns as much from the dining hall as one does from the sessions and informal instruction that went on. So it was very much devoted to the liberal arts. There was not, one could not learn accounting at Harvard College in the first 100 years, or agriculture or anything else. It was a kind of gentleman's, if you like, education on the English model. Now, by the time the Revolutionary War, which of course was 140 years after Harvard was founded, we were up to 9 colleges. So in the first 140 years of America, there were only 9 institutions of higher education founded. So what got off to a fast start did not grow very rapidly, and I stress this because a little later when we talk about what's happened in American higher education in the last 35 years, it's a kind of an astonishing acceleration and exponential change in what the character of American higher education was for the first 140 years. And of course we now come to the time of Jefferson and the kind of Jeffersonian ideal. The Jeffersonian ideal that in a democracy in which every farmer and worker was expected to participate in the life of the polis, the civitas, the community. Jefferson, you know, was of course a farmer who went to Williamsburg to serve his time in the Virginia legislature and then came back to his farm. I mean, there was no such thing as a professional politician. Jefferson would be astonished if he were around today. I mean, the notion, of course, was that people like you and I should go to Washington and take a term or two as congressperson and then go back and be teacher or lawyer or farmer or musician or banker or whatever, and that this truly would be a government of the people and by the people, not just for the people. But Jefferson realized, of course, that people had to be educated. If the people themselves were actually going to manage their affairs, they had to be educated. They had to be able to read and write and know the virtues. I mean, there was a lot of talk in those days about virtue. Another word which has sort of disappeared from our vocabulary. And people had to understand the world in which they lived and know things if they were going to govern themselves. And so there was the Jeffersonian ideal of the educated citizenry. It was very important to Jefferson. You remember when Jefferson died, what he wanted on his monument. He didn't want to put on there that he was President of the United States. Author of the Declaration of Independence and founder of the University of Virginia. Those were the two things that meant the most to him in his life, was the writing of the Declaration of Independence and being the founder of University of Virginia. And if you go to Monticello, you just have that wonderful sense of Jefferson the farmer, you know, riding off from Monticello past his university where new generations were going to be taught to be able to govern themselves in the same kind of model. But of course, Jefferson was an unusual person indeed, wasn't it? Kennedy, when he had the Nobel Prize winners to the White House, said there's not been such intellect and intelligence gathered in the White House since the days in which Jefferson dined alone. And there's something to that. I mean, we just don't have many Jeffersons coming along anymore, but he saw education really for the first time articulated in American higher education as something far beyond just the replacement of the pastors of the church and the education of people for the church. Let me back up for just a minute though and remind you that the founding of Harvard College as a really church-related institution, if you wish, of course, is in an even longer historic tradition, which will be important when you get into the Lutheran colleges later in the week. It's very important to remember that for much of this millennium, education has been the function of the church. If you look, for example, at the Dark Ages, it was in the church in the Western world that learning was preserved. It was in the monasteries of Britain that writing was kept during the 6th, 7th, and 8th centuries. It was the church that sponsored education. The scholars of the world were monks. And in fact, we have remnants of that, of course, today in American higher education. When we have the opening convocation at St. Olaf, the faculty lines up in its robes and gowns. Those, of course, are vestiges of the monastery. The monk's robe and the PhD and master's hoods remind us of the monk's cowls. I mean, that's the origin of the academic garb, is the monastery and the monk's robe and cowl. And so even at the most secular institution today, when the faculty processes in academic garbs, they are hearkening back to that churchly origin of learning and higher education. But in the days of Jefferson, there was this beginning of the broadening of the notion that education was really designed for the education of citizens to govern themselves. And as the nation grew and states were admitted, the importance of education was recognized in land grants to the states as they were admitted in order to enable them to establish centers of learning. Now, Maida and I spent 20 years at the University of Missouri, and so I looked a little bit at the history of the University of Missouri. Missouri was admitted to the nation in 1820. University was founded in 1839. But when Missouri was admitted to the nation, the federal act which admitted Missouri to the nation, granted to the new state two townships for the use of a seminary of learning. And that was typical when a new state was admitted. The federal government, in enacting the legislation that made it a part of the nation, set aside two townships of federal land for the state to have in order to establish a seminary of learning. Now, in the case of Missouri, about 20 years later, the legislature sold the land and it decided to invest it in order to establish the college. And they had, at the time of the university's founding in 1839, the fund amounted to $100,000, which the General Assembly of Missouri thought was enough to endow a university. Mm-hmm. And the General Assembly of Missouri has, for the last 150 years, acted in exactly the same way, I may say. But even to this day, a tiny infinitesimal part of the university's budget is the result of an appropriation by the state of Missouri from the seminary fund. And that's the interest still from that original $100,000 that was gained by selling those lands and investing the money until the university was founded. So the university was founded in 1839, and I thought you might be interested to know, here we are now on what is the close to the frontier, 1839, and the state of Missouri with this beginnings of a university. But the legislature envisioned a statewide university with campuses located in various parts of the state and required that only students who could read in Latin, the first book of the Aeneid, who had studied the higher branches of English, and who had advanced beyond the common school level in English grammar, geography, and arithmetic, should be admitted, not graduated, but admitted. Now imagine going back to your local university and suggest that they should require for admission being able to read the first book of the Aeneid in Latin. See how far American higher education has come from what was the Puritan English liberal arts model the preparation of a gentleman for, and I use that word deliberately, for... Columbia, Missouri was one that bid for the university. In those days, the state, after it sold the money and invested it, would have various parts of the state bid for who wanted the university, and the Columbia, Missouri bid, and they got the university for about $80,000 in cash and $30,000 worth of land. In other states, the bidding was intense, and for other institutions, there's a wonderful story I was told about. I was in Canyon City, Colorado, once, which is, I believe, the site of the Colorado State Penitentiary. And I was told that Colorado, when it was admitted, had a bidding that was for two things. Cities could either bid for the university or the penitentiary. And Canyon City decided at the time that the penitentiary offered vastly more economic potential for the city than did the university. And so they bid for the penitentiary, and Boulder got the university. So and there are days nowadays in which they may be right, actually, given the economic problems of higher education. But anyway, it's very important then to understand that as the nation grew, there was a federal interest in seeing that the states established colleges and universities, and that grew out of this Jeffersonian ideal that the people had to be educated. If we were going to have a democracy, the people had to be educated. Now, the next really significant date in American higher education is 1862. I wonder if anybody knows what happened. I mean, obviously, the Civil War was going on. But another very important event in American higher education occurred in 1862. You might know what that is?
Is that the Morrill Act?
The Morrill Act. And who can tell me what the Morrill Act? Have you heard of the Morrill Act? One of the great landmark pieces of education. Not M-O-R-A-L. No. We are approaching a time when moral and higher education sort of got separated. But Morrill was a man's name, a congressman, and the Morrill Act, Anita knows because she's lived with me too long.
Established the land grant colleges.
Established the land grant colleges, yes. And this was a landmark legislation signed by President Lincoln. And it represents the next really stage in the evolution of American higher education, because what happened was that the Morrill Act gave to each state either land or money, depending on what it needed, in order to establish an institution in which the practical arts, things like agriculture and mining, would be taught. And this reflected really a vast break in the world, really, in higher education. There is no exactly comparable system of higher education anywhere in the world that I know of, except in a few places recently which have tried to adapt the land-grant model to their own situation. Maine and I traveled in West Africa several years ago, and people there were talking about, could one adapt the American land-grant model now in those parts of the world? But somehow it was in America that this idea first really took root. Now, in every state now in the nation, there is a land-grant college. In some states, it's different from the state university. In the state of Washington, for example, the land-grant institution is Washington State. University of Washington is not a land-grant college. So the College of Agriculture, if you want to take agriculture in the state of Washington, the place you would go is to Washington State. In Missouri, which already had a university in 1862, because the University of Missouri was already 23 years old, what they did was simply incorporate the land-grant function into the University of Missouri, so that University of Missouri is both the state university and the land-grant institution. There is no Missouri State University. There's no separate institution. Kansas and Kansas State, Colorado and Colorado State. And there are a few that are funny. There's Arizona and Arizona State, but in that state, Arizona is the land-grant institution. That's where the College of Agriculture is, and Arizona State is not. So in most states, the university that has the word state in it derives from the Morrill Act, except in Arizona. And that may be the only exception, but then Arizona's an exception in a lot of different ways, I suppose. I love Arizona. That's not a slam against Arizona, but they do sort of go their own way sometimes on things like Martin Luther King's holiday and the governors who get impeached and things like that. But in any event, this was a totally new thread in American higher education, but you can see how it came out of the Jeffersonian ideal. I mean, if education is good, then it's good for farmers to know what strains of wheat to plant. And for people who are going to take natural resources out of the earth to know better how to mine. And if we're going to educate people, we ought to educate them for practical things as well as the right.
Are we still only educating men here?
No.
Okay.
No, we're not. Okay. No. And I can't tell you, I believe it was Oberlin that was the first college that admitted women, but that was before this. But I don't remember the date.
Right, yeah, Oberlin.
But I don't remember the date. Do you remember the date, Sook? I don't remember the date.
I don't recall, 1800 something.
But it was before 1862.
Yeah. Right.
It was before
1862.
Mm-hmm. I would guess 1820s or so, somewhere around in there is what I would guess, but I didn't look that up either.
Technical things like engineering and those kinds of sciences, were they included in the land-grant colleges, or was that something you do at Harvard?
Engineering was not at Harvard. Engineering is not explicitly mentioned in the Morrill Act, but mechanic arts is mentioned in the Morrill Act. And so in most universities, in most states, the major engineering program will be at the land-grant college as a derivation from mechanic arts. But in most states now you find engineering at both. I'm sure the University of Washington has engineering as well as Washington State nowadays. Agriculture has generally stayed at one place. But engineering, because of its much broader significance, I suppose, in society, has tended to become everywhere in American education. But if you go to a land-grant college, you will for sure find agriculture, you will for sure find engineering. In some places, you'll find mining and metallurgy and that sort of thing, where there are natural resources. Okay, the next important date in American higher education comes very soon thereafter, in 1878. And you probably will not recognize that date. That is the founding of Johns Hopkins. Anybody know why I should pay particular attention to the founding of Johns Hopkins?
First real medical school,
that's true, but an even broader significance for that. This is the first institution in America that's based on the German model. This is the introduction into America of the German Research University. So we've had an English thread, residential, undergraduate, baccalaureate, liberal arts. We've had a distinctly American practical, let's get about the work of building this country. And now we have a German model, which stressed research, science, medicine, mathematics, physics, which stressed graduate work, publications, departments. This is really the establishment of academic departments in American universities, comes out of the Johns Hopkins model. The mathematicians all wanted to be together because they were interested in mathematics. First, students second. And the historians all wanted to be together because they were going to talk about history and write books and papers and have seminars and speakers in history. And oh yes, by the way, we'll teach. But
that's the way it is today.
But now we'll talk about that a lot. But this was the bringing in of learning, scholarship for its own sake, research, professional schools into the American milieu. And it had fundamental implications for the development of American higher education. And many of the threads of that, as you've observed, are with us today. And we can spend some time talking about that. Let me get on with finish the history, and then we're going to come back and talk about some of these themes and threads. I'm going to skip over quite a few years and move on to the end of World War II. What happened at the end of World War II? The GI Bill. I cannot stress too much the importance that the GI Bill had for American higher education. What did the GI Bill do? There's some people in this room who don't remember the GI Bill, but I do, and you do. Yeah. What did it do?
It paid for education.
People that went to the NOI, they would go.
And what happened? Hundreds of thousands of people went to school.
Enrollment.
And enrollment started booming. And this was a very significant move. For the first time, the federal government gave money to individual people to enable them to go to school. The federal government had supported institutions before. I mean, we saw the government of Massachusetts established Harvard, gave money to establish Harvard College. But for the first time, the American government said, Gary, I'm going to give you money. If you want to go to school, I'll give you money to do it. That's a really fundamental change and a fundamental opening up of American higher education. And from that fact, the great explosion that has occurred in American higher education. And all sorts of things happened after World War II. One of the most important arises after World War II is that of the community college, the vo-tech schools. The two-year used to be called junior colleges. And now, you know, you can't go more than 20 miles in most of America. Around here you probably can, but I mean, in most of America you can't go more than 20 miles before there's a vo-tech school, a community college. And the whole notion that somehow everybody ought to be able to go to college if he or she wants to became part of the American understanding. That it was almost a right of a person to go to college.
How did that happen?
Well, I think the GI Bill was a fundamental part of it, because one of the things the nation realized was that it was desperately short of trained person power. We had people who'd lost a lot of time. We needed to rebuild the society. And the notion that if we send a lot of people to college, and that's one of the ways we can sort of pay back our veterans for what they do, is to say thank you and enable them to build a life. I mean, you can't make a life in America by carrying a gun around or driving a tank. So we'll send them to college and incidentally produce people then who have skills who can help us rebuild the society afterwards. And it didn't matter whether what they were interested in studying or where they came from or what their background was. If they had a high school diploma, they could go to college. And I think it was that kind of egalitarian reintegrating this enormous and varied group of veterans back into society. I can't tell you, but it was a very interesting idea.
But it really targeted only the male population.
Really, that's true, because there were not women.
Right.
There were not women. That's absolutely right.
Yeah. There were some women.
There were some, but it was essentially a male benefit. That's absolutely right. Mm-hmm. It was essentially a male. It wasn't stated that way because it was open to every GI, but I mean every veteran. But there were not many women. That's true.
Well, there weren't many women in the military.
Right, because there were many women in the military. Right. And what has happened now in the years since? In the years since the end of the war, and more recently, is truly astonishing. I have some figures just to indicate the change that's happened. In about 1990, which are the last figures I have, anybody guess how many people in America in 1990 were formally enrolled in institutions of higher education?
10 or 15 million.
10 or 15 million, that's a
good guess.
14 million.
Yeah.
Give that man a gold. 14 million. In 1955, there were about 2.7 million. Now, friends, that's amazing. No, I'm sorry, it's about 3.5, sorry. I didn't do that right. 2.5. I was trying to divide in my head and I missed. Mathematicians can either add to subtract. We don't add, subtract, multiply, or divide, we just prove theorems.
Okay.
And use your calculator.
3.5 million, that's a quadrupling. A quadrupling in 35 years.
What is the population doing?
That's an interesting question. The population in 1955, I think, was about 130 million. And what is it today? 250? Mm-hmm. So it's about doubled. But the rate of college going has quadrupled. Anybody guess how many institutions of higher education there are in the United States? Plus a bunch of other ones. There are about 3,500 institutions. So that's on the average 70 per state, isn't it? 70 per state, right? Of course, some states have a lot more than others.
So that's junior colleges and so on.
That's everything. That's
everything that's accredited.
I say community colleges.
Even non-accredited.
Every degree granting. So it doesn't include Aunt Jane's Barber School in downtown Oakland. Okay. It doesn't include that. But if it grants a degree, it's in this list, accredited or not accredited. But there are not very many unaccredited degree granting institutions.
I see.
3,500 institutions. Now, here's an even more startling. Remember about Johns Hopkins and research and scholarship and all that. Anybody want to guess? I'm going to tell you what university research expenditures were in 1955. University research expenditures in 1955 were $400 million. Anybody want to guess what they were in 1955?
Billions. Billions.
Billions?
I figured we were part of it.
the difference in dollar value between that and
inflation.
There's been some inflation, but not a factor of 35. That's a factor of, this is a factor of 35 times. 35 times.
What is the inflation?
Inflation was perhaps four times?
No, 3.5 at least. Because it triples from the late 60s to today.
Yeah.
Maybe five. Maybe five times, but no more. What did a loaf of bread cost in 1955, Maida? 13 cents?
Mm-hmm.
And now it costs 50? What does a loaf of bread cost today?
Well, it depends on what
bread.
A dollar? Okay. So it's probably a quarter in 1955 and a dollar now, something like that. So inflation's been roughly 4 to 5 times right now. And this is a factor of 35 times. I mean, this is a fact really to ponder as you think about American higher education. And we'll talk some more about the impact of this, both good or bad, in American higher education. Okay, I want to switch now and have you help me think through some of the features of American higher education that are unique. Some of you have had experience in other parts of the world, and I want to focus for the last few minutes on the things about American higher education that are... Mark, we need some more chalk around here. I'm a big consumer of chalk. What would you say? Not right this minute, I mean for some reason. What are some uniquenesses of American higher education?
Variety.
Who said that?
Sook.
It is absolutely the case. Sook, can you speak a little bit about that from your own experience?
I live in three different countries, and I grew up in Korea. It's almost monopolized by government, And in Germany, it is almost monopolized by the federal government, although it has private institutions, but not compared to the U.S. system. One can get lost easily here. Also, one can take advantage of that variety.
This is something Americans do not appreciate enough about higher education. I think most Americans, like we do about other things, think, well, everybody must do it the way we do, you know. And probably everybody has a similar array of institutions of higher education. But the variety of American higher education is astonishing in the world. That we do have 2-year vo-tech programs where you can go and learn auto mechanics, as well as PhD programs in biochemistry in large state universities, as well as large private comprehensive universities, small little church-related liberal arts colleges. It's amazing. And it's very much unique in the world. And it's a thing people can take advantage of if they don't get lost in it. Sook made 2 very good comments. You can get lost in it. And you can also, however, take advantage of it. I mean, whatever you want in higher education, you can find it in America.
It's extremely difficult for parents to decide which school, even elementary school, to send.
Oh, but I'll help you with that at the end.
Well, she's not that old. She's only 5.
Oh,
that's
very
good.
It's not too soon.
But it is. It's very difficult, and it's very difficult for kids as they get into high school, and you know, they get 400 brochures in the mail from all sorts of different institutions, and you know, what's best for me. There's also a very more subtle problem with variety that we'll talk about tomorrow. So, and that is variety begets a kind of covetousness and envy across institutions. And there is a pattern that's caused problems in American higher education in which a 2-year school aspires to be a 4-year school, and a 4-year school aspires to get master's degrees, and a master's degree granting institution aspires to be Harvard University, and that we'll talk about that tomorrow. What's another uniqueness of American higher education?
I think that in the United States, it seems as if the educator takes more responsibility to ensure that the student gets the information. Maybe I'm wrong, but in Europe and Central America, I've traveled a little bit, and if you don't get it, it's not the teacher's fault. It's
so let me put a shorthand, maybe a teacher-centered education, Peter, is that a fair, I mean, that it's sort of dependent on the teacher?
Well, I think the teacher's more responsible for it, too.
Teacher responsible. Okay. How about that?
Or teacher and students ratio is very low here.
So it's just excellent.
How many faculty members in each institution, you can divide them.
It is smaller in America. It's very uneven. You're pointing out how uneven it is. Yeah. And I went to a large university also, and I sat in large lecture classes of about 1,000.
Isn't there regulations?
The first 2 years of college, the university classroom, you sit in like, 200 to 300 people in class.
That's not every class.
That's a lecture class, though.
You have weekly or daily
class
to take it all and so on.
No, well, there'd be small tests. They'd break up, but that'd be once a week.
And if you survive till your junior year, you might get in a class of 30.
Right. Right.
And if you survive till you're in graduate school, you might get in a class of 10.
Right.
Which, of course, in many ways is backwards. We ought to have the first-year students in a class of 10, because they need the help, encouragement, and interpretation. Put the graduate students in a class of 400, because they ought to be able to learn by themselves by that time. But that's another story. I think that's right. I think that derives from another uniqueness. This, I think, is a derivative, though, of another uniqueness of American higher education, and that is access. Why would I put that up there?
I mean, because there's no other country that has comparable access to higher learning. In other words, most of them are much more stratified and elitist or restrict access because of the variety and the number of institutions and the various forms of support. Practically, anyone over 18, any person over 18 can get some kind of higher education.
We believe that everyone in the country deserves an opportunity at higher education. Mm-hmm. And
a higher education, again, means maybe a vocational.
Absolutely. Right. Right. Mm-hmm. Although you raise a very interesting question, which we'll talk about later in the week also, and that is the question of what access means is a very intriguing question. In our state of Minnesota, we'll get into this tomorrow, there was a real tension when the University of Minnesota tried to picture correctly, I think, that access meant access to something, but not necessarily to the University of Minnesota. And the best model for access in that sense is in the state of California, where in the master plan for higher education, it's only the upper, 12.5%, I think, of students who are able to go to the University of California. And then the next tier can go to the California State University systems, and then anybody, no matter where they are in high school, can go to one of the two-year institutions. So, yes, by access, I mean access to some kind of higher education. But for other people, they particularize it to a university and say, by golly, access means I ought to be able to get my kid into the University of Minnesota. And there are some real tensions that occur there. And I think, Peter, your point is absolutely right, and I think it derives from our commitment to access. I mean, if in fact American higher education is going to be seen as open, not just to those who can read the Aeneid in Latin, but to a late bloomer who barely made it through high school, got out just barely graduated, but all of a sudden says, I want to be a lawyer, There ought to be a way for that person to get in to the system and track through the system and come out with a law degree. Then there is perhaps more responsibility on the part of the teacher.
And I think that you look at our secondary schools and our elementary schools, and being a teacher myself, I've watched children that are not being taught self-motivation, that they don't know how to teach themselves. They're being spoon-fed and want to be spoon-fed. So I feel like it's carrying over clear into the, if you have someone that's coming to college and cannot still write a paragraph.
So.
Well, this is at the University of Oregon, and I've seen people get through a four-year education program and get ready to be a teacher and fail a test that was meant for 7th and 8th graders in language and math. One-third of the people that took the test failed it.
It's also testimony to that is the remedial classes that you bring. In colleges. California has many, many. In fact, it's almost required to set up a remedial system.
We're into a very interesting and difficult area that, of course, and once you start talking about these kinds of issues, you can't leave out the elementary and secondary schools because, you know, colleges say, well, we can only deal with what comes to us. Which is true in a way, but in a way also is a cop-out because all the teachers in America were trained in the institutions of higher education, as were most of the school board members and all that sort of thing. And the whole question of where did we lose that kind of level of expectation before we pass someone on to the next level, that's a very interesting and complicated question which goes far beyond higher education, gets into family structure and TV and all sorts of things. But we probably will get into that, and it's absolutely right, Peter, that you mentioned that the teacher responsibility can be put on a spectrum, at one end of which may be very good, in which the teacher says, I'm not just going to dump these handouts and textbooks and let them fend for themselves. On the other hand, it may be very bad if it says, I'm going to spoon-feed this person so she doesn't have to take any... make any effort to learn how to learn or to be motivated or anything. And so there is a spectrum there of teacher responsibility that includes both the good and the bad.
No, I had an instructor at University of Montana that was a math class, and she was from Thailand, and she'd just get up each day and she'd do problems on the board. She hardly spoke any English at all. It was the most useless class. Most of the class would go to the math lab and work in there with the higher students, and then just show up for tests. Because she could, you know, that was her teaching. She'd just do some problems up there, and you should get it. And if she did, you did ask her to explain it, if you could understand what she was saying, you were doing real well. So, I mean, it was like, you know, University of Montana.
And yet, you know, looking at it from her point of view, she had come probably to be a graduate student. To get a master's degree or a doctoral degree. That was her objective. And the teaching was the only way in which she could be supported to do that. And the university, I'm not excusing her, but it's put it in the context. The university probably, if what happened there is typical of what happens at big research universities, is she walked into the math department 2 days before the semester started. They handed her a textbook and a syllabus and said, here's your class list, here's where you show up, go teach. Mm-hmm. And oh, by the way, there's a lecture tonight on how to teach if you have time to come to it. I mean, that's maybe a slight exaggeration, but not too much.
I don't really think it is atypical. One thing you could put on the board there, I mean, the United States is without peer in training highly technically competent individuals. I mean, the one thing that we really do export is expertise. The world comes here to study at the advanced graduate level.
Really helps our balance of payments, doesn't it?
Exactly. But the point is that you have, I mean, I taught at the University of Chicago for 8 years, and every year there were student demonstrations because the entire calculus sequence for beginning students was taught by Pakistanis,
you name it, all over the world, and the students said they just couldn't understand what these teachers were saying. And so they used to organize special study groups with other students at the undergraduate level because they couldn't understand. Mel's quite correct in providing context. Those students came over to study here as part of their funding. They were teaching fellows, and so, you know, it wasn't their fault either, it was the system.
Yeah, it's the university for putting somebody in that doesn't speak English.
And so the University of Chicago is very different from the University of Montana, except in this regard of the graduate research emphasis and the increasing number of students from overseas and a way to fund them, and that's what happened.
And the problem has gotten worse as the academic job market has shrunk. Fewer and fewer American students are going into graduate schools. I mean, in mathematics, my own field today, the number of native English-speaking students in mathematics PhD programs is astonishingly small because the future of jobs in higher education is very uncertain. And so people will go where they see the opportunity for jobs, and they're not going to get PhDs when they can get good jobs in industry for $30,000 a year. Why should they go get a PhD and then be hired as a faculty member at $27,000 a year? Mm-hmm. And that exacerbates the problem of languages. Yes?
Do you see the possibility that an excellent teacher in a certain subject would end up producing a series of videotapes that would be almost like hardcore Cliff's Notes that students would use in order to get around this problem of being taught by people that can't teach? Will there be videos of teachers that can't teach?
I hate to do this, but I'm going to tell you, I'm going to tell a story about exactly that tomorrow. And so I think I'll save that for tomorrow. And if you're not here tomorrow, see me at lunch and I'll tell you a wonderful answer to that story. I want to go on and get some more uniquenesses on the board.
Another uniqueness, and I'm kind of trying to think this through because I know that there's such a variety of costs of going to higher education, but I think that in this country it is expensive. I mean, even if you go to a state university, it's an expensive endeavor. But at the same time, there are a lot of resources available through the government to support through guaranteed student loans and other kinds of options that people have that are basically just need-based and not necessarily scholastically based.
Yeah, no other country has exactly that system of letting colleges charge essentially whatever they want to, but then providing individuals aid. And of course, that derives really from the GI Bill, which was the first time which individuals were given money to college. There are a couple others. Sook alluded to one indirectly when she said, isn't there a federal regulation about the faculty-student ratio? And the answer is no. But in most countries, there would be. The federal government does not control education in America. That's a real uniqueness.
It's very difficult to understand.
Yeah, this is a real uniqueness.
Don't make the colleges a spokesman for the government.
Right.
For one thing.
Right. In most countries, there is a Department of Education which exercises direct control over the universities, in some cases appointing the presidents, for example. In other cases, as in England, directly appropriating the money. English universities get their money through the Government Grants Committee, which is an agency of Her Majesty's government. I don't know whether you remember, but if you remember, at the time in which the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare was being proposed that we establish a Department of Education in Washington, there was a lot of controversy about that. And the controversy was exactly this point. We are not a country in which the federal government controls education, and wouldn't there be a danger if one established a federal Department of Education that the federal government try to control. Now, I didn't write no federal control, I wrote little. And there's a reason for that, because increasingly laws are being passed in Washington that regulate the behavior even of single of college. And this is a kind of disturbing trend, which I hope we'll have a chance to talk about a little bit later. But there have been three such major bills passed in the last year having to do with crime on campus and security and grades of athletes. For example, colleges are now required to report to students what the grades of their athletes are versus their non-athletes, so you can tell whether they're exploiting young men and women by giving them athletic scholarships but not getting them through school. And these are federal laws. This is a very interesting phenomenon. One last unique... Yes.
What about research money that it comes yes. from? That's a very powerful, as witnessed by the situation at Stanford,
right.
for example.
That is absolutely correct. I mean, in technical language, there are no controls with that. There are only audits of how you use the money. I mean, you have to make a proposal, and you have to use the money for what you proposed, and the indirect is supposed to be auditable. But any time there is money given, there are strings, mm-hmm. and increasingly those strings are being pulled. So, you know, 30 years ago, I would have written no federal control. And I hope 30 years from now, whoever's doing this will not write much. But I think that's a... One last point I want to make, because it's really time to go, and it's one that you might not think of, and that is governance. Universities and colleges in America are governed in a very interesting way. They are governed by lay boards. We have a board chairman of a community college in the room today. There's no other country that I know of in the world in which institutions are governed by lay boards. Even a state university, University of Missouri, University of Minnesota, there is a board of regents. It's not governed by the governor. It's not governed by the state government directly. It's governed by a lay board. They're appointed or chosen in different ways, sometimes elected by the legislature, sometimes appointed by the governor. But these are lay people, men and women, bakers and cooks and teachers and bankers and lawyers and business people who govern the university. Private colleges are governed by lay boards. The whole notion of a lay board, my boss is 21 people who are the Board of Regents of St. Paul College. And they hired me, and they can fire me. And that's a very interesting thing. It's not the government who hires and fires presidents of colleges, even for public institutions. It's not the church, in my case, that hires or fires me. It's a lay board. And that's a really interesting and uniquely American phenomenon. Because the other alternative to government control is faculty control. The rector of the University of Oslo is elected by the faculty. The faculty gets together and elects the president for a three-year term. And we are very unusual in having derived a system which is neither government-controlled nor faculty-controlled, but represents the public interest. And even the Board of St. Olaf College is supposed to represent the public interest. So it's a very interesting system. Okay, questions? Wait, it's time to break up. Anything else? Okay, tomorrow, why does college cost so much?